Warren Buffett speaks, the economy listens, we will tell you what he said. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. Monday, everybody, the 10th of August. Great, as always, to have you with us. Dateline Omaha, Nebraska, the wee small hours of the morning. Warren Buffett, via his Omaha-based conglomerate Berkshire Hathaway, is going to spend $32 billion to buy the manufacturing supply company Precision Cast Parts out of Portland, Oregon. Precision, as you might have heard already today, makes the metal pieces that go into turbines and aircraft engines, those kinds of things. It is Berkshire's biggest deal to date and comes during a very active year for mergers and acquisitions overall. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains why and what it means economy-wise.
It's only August, and it's already been a big year for mergers and acquisitions.
By the time the dust settles, it may even be the largest ever.
Anant Sundaram is a professor of finance at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. There are a few reasons for this. One, companies are getting while the getting's good.
It's likely that over the next couple of years, interest rates are going to climb.
David Nelson is chief strategist with BellPoint. Companies sometimes borrow to buy other companies.
And the era of cheap money may start to go away, and it's going to be far more difficult for these firms to get deals done, so they're doing them now.
Another reason for buying other companies?
Growth is harder to come by.
Bill Caffey is a partner with White Summers Caffey & James.
It is easier to buy growth than it is to create it.
Global growth is tepid, so if you're not growing much, just buy someone else and hopefully save money by being more efficient. And there are a few kind of psychological things going on, too, says the Tuck School's Anant Sundaram. One, a lot of companies have saved up a lot of cash, and their shares are valued really highly right now.
I feel wealthy, so I'll go shopping for big-ticket items kind of a phenomenon.
The flip side is that if everyone's shares are highly valued, you're probably overpaying for whatever company you're buying. Lastly, Sundaram says, good old-fashioned peer pressure.
You know, there's a lot of what we call looking over the shoulder kind of behavior amongst CFOs and CEOs. In other words, sort of herding behavior.
Buy because everybody else is doing it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
College is shaping up to be a central issue in this presidential campaign, or more specifically, the cost of colleges. Hillary Clinton rolled out her ideas for making college more affordable today, even though the plan itself comes with a $350 billion with a B dollar price tag. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott has more.
You've heard it so many times, I probably don't need to remind you that Americans collectively owe more than $1 trillion in student loans. Mark Huelsman with the think tank Demos says a lot of them will be voting, which is why he says three Democratic candidates are pitching some version of debt-free college.
The generation that's really coming of age politically, the millennial generation, you know, is the generation that has had to borrow the most and for whom student debt really is the most acute crisis they're probably facing economically.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders wants to eliminate tuition at public universities. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley aims to make public college tuition-free within 5 years. Hillary Clinton's plan would give federal grants to states if they make community college tuition-free and create a no-loan option at four-year colleges. Carmel Martin with the Center for American Progress advised the Clinton campaign on its proposal.
The goal would be that no student would have to borrow to pay for a public four-year tuition.
Families would be expected to make a, quote, reasonable contribution, and students would have to work 10 hours a week. States would also be required to increase funding for public colleges after years of cutbacks. Andrew Kelly with the American Enterprise Institute says none of these plans addresses the real problem in higher education.
What we really want to do is we want to reduce the cost of delivering higher education, not necessarily just shift the costs around.
Whoever becomes president can only do so much without Congress. A GOP aide says the Senate Education Committee is working on its own plan to help students graduate more quickly with less debt. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I don't know, I guess traders decided a week's worth of the sad music was long enough. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A I'm not really sure how to tell you this, but that sentence that has become a staple of the internet age, namely, I'm going to go Google that when one doesn't know something, may have to change just a little bit. Today, the company formerly known as Google announced a corporate restructuring. Google, as we know and love it, will be part of a bigger holding company, which will be called Alphabet. Marketplace's Molly Wood is here to make me smart on this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So first of all, I'm still totally Googling things, or at least I'm going to say that. But question number one has to be why. What gives?
Well, the good news is you can keep Googling things.
All right,
I think what Alphabet is thinking here is to essentially streamline things at Google. They will take the company previously known as Google, strip it down to its nuts and bolts, which are search, Gmail, Google Photos, the things that it has done so well for so long, and create this larger company called Alphabet, which frees them up to do all of the weird things they had sort of been packing into Google before, like extending life indefinitely or going to the moon.
What happens then to Google itself? It is Google within this larger enterprise.
It is. So okay. Google, the search engine and mail company and information gatherer, will stay the same, and it will get a new CEO in Sundar Pichai. He was previously its senior vice president, and he oversaw Android and Chrome and Google. And it will just get a lot more streamlined. And I think what people are hoping is that it will get a lot more focused on that Google business.
We've been talking for a long time about how search maybe ain't all that anymore, right? Not as dominant as it used to be for this company. Mm-hmm. This has to be a reflection of that.
I think it absolutely is. It's more a reflection that it can't keep growing like a rocket ship.
Right.
Google still makes a lot of money on search, but you know, the days of them being the absolutely dominant player that prints money are kind of over, and they need a little focus if they're going to maintain. But this also lets the new company Alphabet fund a lot of projects off of the pretty substantial amounts of money that Google still makes.
Yeah. Why do you suppose investors after hours on this puppy were like so crazy excited? It's up, I don't know, 4 or 5%, something like that?
Yeah. I mean, part of that could just be that they're excited to see any action during the slow summer days. But no, investors and I think even employees at Google had been calling for focus for a while. The company is really at risk of being distracted by all the different things that Larry Page and Sergey Brin want to do. They have big imaginations. But they've been spending a lot of Google money trying to pursue those moonshots. And so I think that investors are excited at the prospect of a more focused Google that could keep making them more money and the possibility that Larry and Sergey unleashed might come across the next really, truly transformative big moneymaker.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent talking to us about Google Alphabet, Alpha Google, I don't know. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
At the risk of sounding cliche, there is an app right now for pretty much anything you want. Thai food? Done. Ride to the airport? Done. Custom fit tailored shirt? Also done. You need medical care sooner rather than later? Yeah, no, sorry. Dr. Renee Dua is trying to change the way we do doctor's visits with, yes, an app. For $99, they will send a doctor to your house within an hour. So I went out to her offices in Santa Monica for another story about the tech sector here in Southern California. And I asked her how she went from being an MD, she still does practice, by the way, to a tech startup CEO.
It's an exciting thing. 10 years ago, I started my own private practice. And I was the youngest woman for miles and miles and miles. So I became very, very busy very quickly. Then I got married, and I married a serial entrepreneur. And one night we were taking my boy to the emergency room. After about 8 hours, we finally saw an attending physician. And she just looked at me and said, "There's nothing wrong with your son. Go home." It was midnight, and I was furious. And I said to Nick, my husband, that we've got to come up with a better way to do this.
Was there a light bulb moment then where you said, okay, it's going to be app-based and we're going to have the doctors drive around? I mean, what was the sort of the forcing factor there?
So it really was the idea that within 60 minutes, you'll have the peace of mind that a doctor's in your house or in your office or in your place of work. It really was that idea. And it was born out of our experience, because imagine waiting for 8 hours and having no idea what's going on versus 60 minutes of a professional showing up in your home and making everything better.
Do you employ the doctor? Is he a freelancer? Does the person pay you and then
That's
you give the doctor
question.
A cut? How does all that
and
work?
So we have a little bit of both. We have doctors that work with us full time, and this is their career. It's very expensive to be a doctor in private practice, and it really, to be frank, doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. Now, when doctors graduate, they don't know how to run a business, and so they sign up to work at a capitated healthcare system, Kaiser or Healthcare Partners right. or Regal. So it's very appealing to doctors to come and work with us full time because they don't have any overhead. We handle all of the expenses, we deal with the billing, and their job is to see patients, and that's why they became doctors in the first place.
If you think about the bigger healthcare cost picture, though, what's a better use of a physician's time, right? A highly trained, very expensive person's time. Is it driving from here to El Segundo to see somebody, or is it sitting there in an office so that all these patients whose time is worth less can come to him?
And your question is very well taken. So that's all about how we scale our product. It's not that we have the doctor who's based in Santa Monica driving to El Segundo. There's a doctor 5 minutes away in El Segundo who can see patients in El Segundo. And so that doctor might do 2 visits in an hour.
Talk to me about scale for a second. You're here, you're in Santa Monica, you're LA, you're in San Francisco.
Correct.
With expansion plans, yeah?
Absolutely.
How do you deal then with like cross-state border licensing requirements and medical boards and all that happy hoo-ha?
Piece by piece. I've got a great team.
You're going to figure it out?
It's already being figured out. It's all in progress. And that is, you know, as you may know, and I'm sure you're aware, California is a very difficult state mm-hmm. to do anything in. After you've conquered California, I think, you know, the sky's the limit.
Why are you here in Santa Monica? Why aren't you up in Silicon Valley where the center of the tech universe is?
This is Silicon Beach, right? This mm-hmm. is where it's all beginning. There are 400,000 some odd jobs for tech startup interested people here. We've got an incredible team of people working behind us. And they're all here for one reason, and that is they want to change the world.
We took our cameras out to Santa Monica. We've got a video of Dr. Dua talking about Heal, H-E-A-L is her company. On our Facebook page, we're at Marketplace, APN. Coming up.
This is our way of, I think, assaulting multi-generational poverty.
It's not what you're trying to do, but how you're doing it that gets people going. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, hello, old friend. The Dow Delta is up 241 points, nearly 1.4% today, 17,615 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 58 points, 1.1%, finished at 5101. The S&P 500 up 26 points, 1.2%, ended things at 2104. So, Warren Buffett, as we told you, Berkshire Hathaway is buying Precision Castparts. Berkshire shares off just a hair. Castparts up 19% today. Buffett played down speculation that Kraft Heinz, in which he does have by the by a big stake, might be a buyer for Mondelez International, which, as you know, if you listened to us last week, makes Oreo cookies and Ritz crackers, among many, many, many other things. Shares in Kraft Heinz up 0.4%. Mondelez shares up 0.6%. Today, Twitter co-founder and interim CEO Jack Dorsey bought himself 31,000 shares of the company. Today, Twitter shares up 9% on the day, as is the rest of his holdings, it should be said. Also, Google or Alphabet or whatever you want to call it, up after hours 4.9% and still moving around. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for June. Elsewhere in the Capitol, kind of quiet. Congress is in recess through Labor Day. And on August 11th, 1934, Alcatraz opened its doors to the first group of federal prisoners. If you're arriving today, you're probably a tourist. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A little piece of American sporting history died this weekend. Football Hall of Famer Frank Gifford was 84 when he passed away unexpectedly yesterday. To a lot of people, Gifford was probably better known as a member of the Monday Night Football crew through the 1970s and the 80s and most of the 90s, or even possibly known as Kathy Lee Gifford's husband. It's because he played and starred in the NFL before football became the national sport in this country, back when boxing was a Friday night feature on network television and football was more college, really, than pro. So maybe more than anybody else in the history of the game, Gifford's career is a timeline for what football in America has become. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes it from there.
Let's start with a little context. Last year's number one draft pick, Jadeveon Clowney, signed a contract with the Houston Texans for more than $22 million a year and got $14 million just for signing. Frank Gifford was the number one pick of the New York Giants in 1952.
He signed for a $250 signing bonus.
Jackson Michael wrote The Game Before the Money. He says Gifford played for a whopping $8,000 a year. The son of an oil field worker was a star at USC. But when he got to the NFL, more people were interested in baseball than pro football.
You know, the league wasn't as popular back then in 1952. Television really helped increase pro football's popularity.
And when Gifford retired, TV was waiting.
So it was like, okay, we need an NFL guy.
That's Coach TJ Troop. He's a former player and coach who's written two books on the NFL. He says hiring Gifford in the early 60s to help broadcast was a no-brainer.
If you were a Giant in Manhattan and playing well, why not make the transition if you can?
Gifford joined Monday Night Football in its second season in 1971. In his 26-year tenure, the broadcast went from strictly X's and O's to a celebrity culture all its own, and so did football. Jackson Michael says today's game is as much about theater as it is about winners and losers.
Yeah, it's much more entertainment. It's made for television.
Which translates into big bucks for owners and teams. One estimate has the league's TV revenue alone topping $6 billion next year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One of the many changes Hurricane Katrina brought to New Orleans 10 years ago was a rethink of public housing. It had been on people's minds before the storm, yes, but the flooding sped up the plans quite a bit. Developers and city leaders, even residents of the housing projects themselves, saw an opportunity to start over. The St. Bernard development was one of the places that people were talking a lot about, a collection of two- and three-story brick houses in the Gentilly neighborhood. About 900 or so families lived there before Katrina. And depending on who you talk to, it was either a place of community or a place rife with crime. Today, St. Bernard is gone, replaced by a mixed-income development called Columbia Park. Marketplace's Noel King took a look around.
Can you push it high? Good job! Yay!
This is one perk of living in Columbia Park. Free classes for toddlers, Michaela, through the on-site EduCare program. I'm taking a tour with J.T. Hannon, a public affairs director for the Bayou District Foundation. That's the nonprofit that developed Columbia Park and brought EduCare here.
This, to me, is the crown jewel of the whole development. This is our way of, I think, assaulting multi-generational poverty. Children who come from low-income families typically receive no preschool. They start behind, they stay behind.
Not Columbia Park kids. The development has a cradle-to-college education model, a K-8 school, and a high school for residents' kids are both in the works.
So here's a fitness center.
Columbia Park has a movie theater, a fitness center, a swimming pool, beautiful homes, and three types of renters. The first, public housing tenants who pay a third of their income to rent. Another group, also low income, pay a fixed amount. The last group have middle class jobs, police officers, professors, and pay market rate. Hannon says everyone is treated the same.
Everybody's on the same lease. Whether you make over six figures or you're completely dependent on public subsidy, every resident needs to adhere to three conditions.
Those rules are you have to work at least 20 hours a week, you have to pass a credit check, you cannot have a recent felony conviction. And this, fundamentally, is what makes it different from the old St. Bernard housing project. Only certain people can live here. I took a walk through Columbia Park alone. Robert Lewis was cutting through on his bike to get a cold drink at the store. Lewis is 42. He grew up in St. Bernard and was displaced by the flood. He does not live here now. In fact, only just over 100 of the former St. Bernard families out of 900 live in Columbia Park. Lewis doesn't remember St. Bernard being a bad place. He says, yes, some people used or sold drugs, but...
It wasn't like you come outside and you get killed. It wasn't like that, you know. It wasn't like bad, 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 you know, like everybody... I think it was, but it wasn't.
Lewis lives nearby and says he's on the waiting list for a Section 8 housing voucher. He can't get in here. He has a felony drug conviction. But he says even if Columbia Park did accept him, he wouldn't live here.
No, I would not.
Why not? It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful, but you can't really, it's too strict back here.
What are the rules that you don't like?
What do you see right now?
I don't see anyone, to be honest.
That's right. That's the point right there, you know what I'm saying? You don't see nobody outside. You can't even have a barbecue outside or none of that, you know what I'm saying?
Lewis admits there is one thing he likes about the improvements Columbia Park has helped bring to the neighborhood. There's a place to hang out.
You know what you got to do later on?
What's that?
You can go take your walk over there by the under the bridge. They got the little skate park that they built for the skating people, you know what I'm saying? We got white people, blacks, all to be under the skating all day long, you know what I'm saying?
I decided to go looking for the skate park that Mr. Lewis, the former resident, told me about. And the truth is, at 10:15 on a Wednesday morning, I do see what he's saying. There's no one outside. Of course, it is a work day, and remember, working is a rule here. But then I spotted a young guy, and he was carrying a skateboard.
Hi. Hey, can I ask you a quick question? I'm a tiny bit lost.
I told him what I was up to.
And I'm just doing a story about what it's like to live here. And there's a couple things people told me about. The skate park was one.
Yeah.
Is that where you're going?
Yeah.
Can I go with you?
Sure.
Jerome Lipscomb is 18 and lives in Columbia Park with his grandmother. He lived in St. Bernard, too. He was displaced by the flooding at age 8. And he, too, has some really good memories.
We'll play, like, baseball with a tennis ball. We play cool cans. A lot of different stuff. It was kind of fun.
He says Columbia Park, despite the movie theater and the computer lab, is less fun. He resents a little that St. Bernard was demolished.
That's where I was born and raised. It was tragic, but, I mean, I had to get over it. Life got to go on. It's quiet. It's more cleaner, but I prefer the old St. Bernard.
Jerome has goals. He plays a bunch of instruments in church and school, snare drum, bass drum, saxophone. He makes a little money playing in the French Quarter. He plays baseball and has his eye on an athletic scholarship. We reach the skate park just outside of Columbia Park below Interstate 610, and I tell Jerome, for all his nostalgia, the idea is that growing up here will afford him a better future. So, does he buy that? He thinks for a while.
Yes. I think Columbia Park is better. I mean, we had took a college tour to the Naval Academy in Baltimore. I have like a mentor. He worked at Columbia Park. His name is Mr. Terrell Haynes. There's a lot of tips they give us, a lot of good feedback. So, I mean, it is good. Not everything about it is bad.
Jerome went off to start his day, and I went off to find his mentor, Mr. Terrell Haynes.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. Are you Mr. Haynes?
Yes, I am.
So nice to meet you.
Same here, same here. So what did Jerome, how did I get thrown this into the...
Haynes is a social worker for a nonprofit organization called Kingsley House. He works on site at Columbia Park, providing counseling for anyone who needs it. That wasn't an option at St. Bernard. He had no idea Jerome saw him as a mentor.
I appreciate his compliment. And I just see myself as being that person who has wandered into Jerome's life, just being an influence in some form or fashion.
Haynes has his own memories of St. Bernard.
The crime was rampant. I had high school teammates that lived in the development. And when I would drop them off late evenings, I was often told, don't stop at the red light. Just keep going. Don't stop at the red light. Just keep going.
Haynes is a big believer in mixed-income developments, and he believes Jerome will have a better life for growing up here.
Growing up in the St. Bernard, if you didn't have a strong-knit family providing that structure, you could easily succumb to the underground, criminal activities, for the lack of a better word. Him growing up in this environment, him having the ability to reach me whenever necessary, I mean, he has my cell phone number.
And what does he predict for Jerome?
He's going to be, if he's not playing in the major leagues, he's probably going to be playing an instrument. You know, I can see him being along the lines of a Wynton Marsalis or a Harry Connick Jr. I mean, the guy is just that good. He's just that good.
Great expectations from a mentor. Haynes tells me he kept up with some of those old teammates who lived in St. Bernard. A few of them did really well. One played pro football. But he says they were really the exception. If Columbia Park's model works, he says, success for everyone is going to be the rule. In New Orleans, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
We've got all of our coverage from New Orleans 10 years after Katrina online. It's marketplace.org. The This final note on the way out today, in which Facebook and its all-knowingness about us gets even creepier. They decided, Facebook did apparently, that they wanted to know how people express laughter online because, I don't know, on the internet nobody can hear you laugh, I guess. Anyway, here's the nut graph, and I do recommend reading the whole note from the Facebook research people. We'll put a link up on our website as soon as we can. Here you go. 15% of people included laughter in a post or a comment the week they did the study. Fine. The most common laugh is ha-ha, followed by various emoji, and then a heh-heh, that's H-E-H-E in case I'm pronouncing it wrong. Age and gender apparently do play a role. Young people and women prefer emoji, whereas men prefer longer heh-hehs, which sounds kind of creepy. I know, LOL, apparently, is passé. Alrighty, out we go. The Dow up 241 points today, nearly 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 58 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 up 26 points, 1.2%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.